This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean-Cooley, TV critic for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. When actor James Stewart addressed the 1972 Republican National Convention, he was sweating profusely. Why? Because police outside had sprayed so much mace at demonstrators, it was sucked into the air conditioning ducts and triggered a shutdown of the cooling system. That's the kind of detail you'll read in the latest book by today's first guest, writer Rick Perlstein. Perlstein's book is an evocative trip through the 60s and early 70s and an assessment of the impact of Richard Nixon's political career. Perlstein argues that many of the deep political divisions in modern American politics were defined by that period and exploited effectively by Nixon. Rick Perlstein is a writer and historian. His previous book was Before the Storm: Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies spoke to Perlstein about his new book called Nixon Land: The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America.
Well, Rick Perlstein, welcome to Fresh Air. This book is a great read. It's sort of a fascinating ride through the late 60s and early 70s, sort of seen centered on the career of Richard Nixon. Let's talk a little bit about Nixon's early life. You say that he was a serial collector of resentments. What resentments did he collect growing up?
Well, he was a real loner. Apparently, according to the early oral histories, he wouldn't ride on the school bus because he thought the other kids smelled. He was very lonely. He spent all his time up in his father's his father had a grocery store in a former church, and he would go up into the bell tower and read and read and read and read and read. And by the time he made it to college, he was working three times harder than everyone else. He was very smart, and he received a scholarship to Harvard. And he never went to Harvard. He never went to Harvard because his family basically couldn't afford the train ticket from Whittier. They couldn't afford to send him there from Whittier, California, the small Quaker town in Southern California where he grew up. So he went to this local school, Whittier, which was a fine school, but, you know, was not Harvard, which he bore anger and resentment towards the rest of his life. I mean, you can hear him raging about it on the Nixon tapes. And when he got to Whittier, the first thing he did as kind of young man on the make was try to join the school's one fraternity, which were called the Franklins. And they wouldn't let him in. He was too uncool. So he started his own fraternity. His own fraternity was called the Orthogonians, which he said meant upright or upstanding. And basically, he created a fraternity for the uncool kids. And this turned out to be a brilliant way to charter his political career. Soon he was the student body president. And the secret of success was that the uncool people in society outnumber the cool people. And someone who speaks to their resentments at being looked down upon could reap a harvest of popularity, which is what he did all through his career and every step of the way. He later would call that group of people the silent majority.
Let's move forward a bit. Your book really focuses on the years, I guess, in between like 1966 and 1972. And you note that you describe 1964, which was the year that Goldwater, of course, lost in a landslide election to Lyndon Johnson, as a liberal apotheosis, an apparent national liberal consensus. Explain what you mean.
Yeah, that was what the pundits said at the time. Lyndon Johnson won with about 61% of the vote. And basically, people like James Reston and Walter Lippmann, who were kind of like the Tom Friedmans of their day, said that if the Republican Party wants to win another election ever, they'll have to purge the conservatives. They'll have to purge the right-wingers who have been completely repudiated by the electorate. And it seems so. I mean, when Lyndon Johnson was nominated, he basically had a 2-to-1 majority of progressives or liberals in the Senate, and they passed Senate and the House of Representatives, and they passed, you know, the great social legislation that we're still, you know, enjoying, I would say, today: Medicare, Medicaid, the NEA, the NEH, the first environmental legislation, legal aid, of course, and the culmination of that, the absolute apotheosis of the apotheosis, was the Voting Rights Act.
So there was a sense of tolerance and consensus in the land. Now, we go to 1968, and things are very different. I mean, America is roiling with cultural trends which are disturbing to a lot of people. And And, you know, you describe a point before the New Hampshire primary of 1968. And this struck me as sort of, again, just an example of what some of the roiling social conflicts that were going on. You'd had the Newark riots the year before, 30-some-odd people killed. A report came out on urban riots, the Kerner Commission, in February. On February 17th, the Black Panthers gathered to celebrate Huey Newton's birthday, and one of them, James Forman, advocates killing police, sheriffs, and southern governors. That's widely reported. At a police chief's convention, they were displaying armored personnel carriers to deal with civil unrest. And into that climate, we have Richard Nixon staging his comeback. Tell us how he exploited some of that atmosphere, those fears and anxieties, in maneuvering his way to the presidency.
Well, at first he didn't, and that certainly baffled me at first. I mean, the tail end of the story about the signing of the Voting Rights Act was 5 days later were the Watts riots, you know, and they were seen live on TV because KTLA, the television station in Los Angeles, was the first station to have a news helicopter. And in 1966, Lyndon Johnson proposed what was supposed to be the third triumphant apotheosis-like civil rights bill. And this was a civil rights bill that had as its centerpiece an open housing amendment, that an open housing title that would make it illegal to say, I'm not going to rent my house to someone because they're the wrong race. And that year, it went up in flames. I mean, it basically the whole notion that we had this kind of tolerant nation that was passing more and more civil rights legislation just went up in smoke. And the reason it probably went up in smoke was because of all the riots that broke out in city after city, in Cleveland, in Chicago, and even places like Des Moines. Richard Nixon was very busy in 1966. It really was the pivotal year of his comeback. He campaigned for tons and tons and tons of congressional candidates. He worked his tail off. And so he campaigned in city after city after city, and he never mentioned this stuff. He never mentioned the backlash. People like Ronald Reagan and people like George Wallace, the respectively governors, gubernatorial candidate for California governor and the governor of Alabama would mention it all the time. And Nixon didn't mention it, I think, because he knew he had to reestablish his reputation as a statesman and not a gutter snipe. But by 1968, when you get things like the Kerner Commission report, he kind of pivots and he goes all in. And that's when he starts giving speeches about how we have to crush these insurrections by any means necessary and really kind of casts himself as kind of the field general in the culture war.
Yeah, now he was facing some tough Republican opposition for the Republican presidential nomination. John Lindsay, the former mayor of New York, George Romney, father of Mitt Romney, who George Romney was the governor of Michigan. How did he use these fears and resentments to make himself a different kind of politician, to advance his political interest?
He had this gift for seeing the angers and the resentments that kind of roiled slightly beneath the surface. In that 1966 congressional election where he worked so hard, the Republicans picked up 47 seats. I mean, basically everyone who won on Lyndon Johnson's coattails in 1964 lost in 1966. I mean, basically we had 2 years of this heroically liberal Congress.
You know, by 1968, Nixon has taken a different tack, right, and has decided that there's a different way to elect Republicans.
Yeah. And the way he does it is he runs a commercial hour after hour after hour. You couldn't turn on the TV in the fall of 1968 without seeing Richard Nixon's commercial bearing the slogan, the first civil right of every American is to be free from domestic violence. So he basically turns the civil rights argument on its head and said the people who were suffering deficits in civil rights were actually white middle-class Americans.
It's interesting. You note that the California primary of 1968 is remembered for Robert Kennedy's win on the Democratic side and then, of course, his assassination that very night. But forgotten, you say, is something that Nixon saw in the results of that primary, which was a sign to him that the shape of the American electorate was shifting. Describe that, will you?
There was a fellow by the name of Max Rafferty. I can't imagine a more obscure name in the annals of recent American politics. He was the education commissioner in California, and he had basically won office in 1962, railing against things like swear words in dictionaries in school libraries, you know, railing against progressive education, railing against even this teaching of evolution in schools. And he ran for Senate in 1968 against an enormously popular liberal Republican by the name of Tom Kuchel, who was the Senate whip. And no one imagined that California would turn out such a powerful senator who basically brought home so much bacon to California. And on the same day that Robert F. Kennedy won the California primary, Max Rafferty won the Republican primary. And in fact, he was on a glide path to winning a Senate seat. This guy who was very extreme, very conservative. And the only reason he was kept from winning was a newspaper reporter discovered a week or two before the election that he had dodged the draft during World War II.
But that was the general election, right? In the primary, he won.
The general election. He won resoundingly and absolutely stunned the pundits. Of course, the pundits were serially stunned. They were stunned over and over again by these conservative groundswells that they never saw coming.
So at a time when a lot of people looked at California and saw a nation embracing the return of a Kennedy and a liberal political philosophy, Nixon saw the beginning of a national realignment, right? I mean, is this when he embraced the Southern strategy? Yeah.
Yes, and political observers should have noticed it much earlier, because on election day in 1964, when Lyndon Johnson won California by a million votes, and this was seen as this kind of national consensus for civil rights, on that same day there was an initiative on the ballot against an open housing law, and that also won by a million votes.
You tell a fascinating story here of how Nixon connected with his media consultant, Roger Ailes. How did they meet?
Roger Ailes was the producer, a very young producer, by the way. One of the ironies of the 60s was young people were seen as these kind of avatars of the left and the counterculture. But actually, Roger Ailes was younger than Tom Hayden. He was younger than Abbie Hoffman. And he was the producer of a local show in your own town of Philadelphia called The Mike Douglas Show. And he was a young whiz kid producer. And they had on, in this pivotal year, as I say, for Nixon's career, 1966, Richard Nixon in the makeup chair getting ready to go on the Mike Douglas show. And Nixon is making small talk with this kid and saying, oh, you know, isn't it ridiculous, you know, that the things you have to do to get elected president these days, go on, you know, a midday show that watched by housewives. And Roger Ailes fixed him in the eye and said, if you think that this is silly, you're never going to become president. And Nixon immediately sent him to New York and ended up hiring him as his media consultant for the 1968 election, where he invented something that's still with us today, the kind of ersatz town hall meeting, in which basically a supposed cross-section of Americans grilled the candidate before a carefully selected audience friendly to the candidate. And that let Roger Ailes cut these things into these TV commercials that made Nixon look enormously smart, charming, heroic, all the rest.
So it was an entirely staged event, but it looked like he was being spontaneous and taking citizens as they come. And one of the fascinating things that you reveal here is that they would often bring somebody in who was too hard-edged, too openly racist, too brazenly conservative. The point being what?
Right. So there's a story. They're having one of these shows, and they're always done locally so that he could kind of spin local issues in local ways, right? And one of the people they had chosen for the panel turned out to be a psychiatrist. And Richard Nixon had earlier told Len Garment that he would do anything to be president except see a shrink. So Len Garment realizes he has this irrational hatred or fear or whatever of psychiatrists. He's like, we got to get the shrink off the panel. But it's the last minute, and they don't know what to do. They have to fill someone in the panel. And Roger Ailes, in this absolutely astonishing quote in Selling of the President, which, you know, I'm not sure people have paid a lot of attention to, says, well, let's get a George Wallace supporter, a cab driver. And Roger Ailes said, he can say, all right, Mac, what are you going to do about the, and then he used a racial slur, that begins with N. You know, Roger Ailes recounting how they should get a cab driver. And the whole point of that was then Richard Nixon could come back and deplore that awful language, deplore the sentiments, but basically endorse the same kind of backlash politics that George Wallace was promoting, just in more polite language.
He could be anti-busing, but in a more reasoned way.
Sure, he could do it in four-syllable words and not say things like George Wallace, who said that we don't have riots in Alabama, we just shoot them in the head.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask you about George Wallace. You know, your thesis is in part that Nixon is to some extent responsible for the kind of deep divisions of America that we have today in between, you know, red states and blue states and hard partisan battling on political and ideological lines. But you had George Wallace in the election in 1968 and again in 72. And he was, you know, in some respects, a much more divisive figure. Why in the end do you regard Nixon as a more effectively polarizing force in American politics?
Well, George Wallace never could have been elected president. And in 1966 or 1968, Ronald Reagan probably never could have been elected president because they seemed extreme. And Richard Nixon was able to couch these sentiments in very noble-sounding terms. And by the way, he ran in 1968 as the proverbial uniter, not a divider. He said, bring us together.
Right. But the together was a certain definition of those he was bringing together.
Yeah, when he gave his silent majority speech in 1969, basically he defined the silent majority as the non-shouters, the non-protesters. Well, what they were protesting for was basically withdrawal from Vietnam. And his very argument in that speech, the silent majority speech, in which he proposed the doctrine of Vietnamization, which he was going to start withdrawing troops and turning the Vietnam War over to the South Vietnamese, was withdrawal from Vietnam. So basically he said the people who are making the same argument I'm making, but look different from you, smell different from you, raise their voices, are not quite American at all.
You know, one of the most memorable phrases from this period comes from Vice President Spiro Agnew, who was vice president under Nixon, and he referred to the media, the press then, as the nattering nabobs of negativism. Now, I think this comes from the congressional elections of 1970, I believe, when he and Nixon stumped all around the country for conservative senators and congressmen. Give us an idea of their approach, the rhetoric they used, and its impact.
Well, this is 1970 when the most transfixing event of the year happened in May, when four students were shot at Kent State in Ohio. Actually, 13 students were shot, but four died. And afterwards, these insurrections broke out on almost 1,000 college campuses. It was absolutely astonishing. And really, it seemed like America was on the verge of open violence, almost in the streets. And this was the year that Richard Nixon thought he could finally win a majority in the Senate. And he could finally kind of have his will in foreign policy by taking advantage of this social discord in order to campaign for conservative candidates. His point man in this actually was his vice president, Spiro Agnew. And he gave this absolutely scathing series of speeches. Now, lo and behold, it didn't succeed for whatever reason. And it's a complicated set of circumstances involving economics, certainly involving the Democrats co-opting some of that law and order rhetoric. The Republicans did terribly that year. And a lot of people make the argument that that was the trauma that finally brought Nixon to the brink of Watergate, that he couldn't stand this loss of control, that kind of democracy hadn't worked for him almost, and he was going to try other means.
Do you think, I mean, even though it was a failed electoral strategy, do you think that the impact on political discourse was significant?
Yes. What he did was he had kind of reverted to the rhetoric. He and Spiro Agnew, I should say, reverted to the rhetoric of a George Wallace in 1968. He had forgotten his lesson that you have to present yourself in a time of tumult as someone who is an antidote to the tumult. But he just looked like that year, and he made the Republicans look that year just like another part of the roiling Civil War. He didn't appear to be above the divisions. He didn't appear to be transcendent, and he was punished at the polls.
When Nixon ran for re-election in 1972, There were a number of Democratic candidates, and the strongest contender was Edmund Muskie, who veterans of the time will remember was the senator from Maine who had been the vice presidential candidate for the Democrats in 68, a strong centrist candidate. And Nixon clearly did not want to run against him. He preferred to run against George McGovern, the liberal from South Dakota. And he undertook to make sure that Muskie would not be the nominee. What did Nixon do to ensure that Muskie wouldn't be the Democratic nominee?
He cheated. And the most sort of fragrant tactics were basically ones that were meant to sabotage the campaigns of every Democratic candidate who he thought that he couldn't beat in November, so that he would be running against the one he thought he could beat, who was the anti-war. Well, they were all anti-war candidates. Basically, everyone, even Scoop Jackson, was saying we needed to get out of Vietnam. But he wanted to run against George McGovern because he seemed like the furthest left viable candidate. And so he would do things, or more accurately, his deputies would do things like stealing Muskie stationery, writing a nasty letter about how some other candidate had fathered a child out of wedlock, sending it out to the media, and making it look like the Muskie team was spreading smears about some other candidate. And then he would take another candidate stationery, say Hubert Humphreys, and do the same thing. They had a word for it that basically you can't say in a family radio station, but it worked. Edmund Muskie eventually withdrew from the race because he was so mercilessly harassed by a letter to a New Hampshire newspaper that turned out to have been written by the White House. It was called the Canuck Letter. Later when they, it was investigated and the Washington Post exposed that it had been written by the White House. The Canuck Letter basically was a letter to the editor saying, "I down in Florida heard Edmund Muskie call French Canadians Canucks," which was basically the N-word for French Canadians in New Hampshire, who were an important part of the electorate there. And, it was all made up. It was written by a White House aide. And it so incensed Edmund Muskie that he gave this passionate speech to defend himself right in front of the newspaper. And he either did or didn't cry during that speech. Some people think it might have been just a snowflake in his eye or something like that. And when that got out, and when people like David Broder put it all over the papers that this guy had cried on the stump, he was done for.
When the sabotage of Muskie and other candidates' campaigns began to take effect, did the Democratic candidates suspect each other? Did any of them think that the Republicans might have been behind this?
There was a really fascinating moment where there was a third-party candidate who was, just absolutely completely marginal. He was a John Birch Society member named John Schmitz. And he ran on the line of George Wallace's old party and, got less than 1% of the vote. And he gave a quote to the newspapers in which he said, "I bet that Richard Nixon is sabotaging these Democratic campaigns so he could run against George McGovern." And this was kind of presented as this kind of hilarious example of this crazy John Birch Society guy who was running for president.
I just want to come back to one second for when these dirty tricks were being played on the Democrats during the Democratic primary campaign, when Muskie and McGovern and others were battling it out. And when all these nasty things started to happen, you write in this book, it was surpassingly strange. Democratic campaigns usually weren't like this. In the watering holes where rival campaign staffers met to unwind, to gently chide each other, exchange war stories, a veil of hostility descended between camps. The Democrats thought that they were after each other, right?
Yeah, no one suspected what was going on. This technique worked like a charm. Basically, these false flag operations, as they call it in the intelligence world, achieved their purpose. Hubert Humphrey thought that Edmund Muskie was sabotaging him, and Edmund Muskie thought Hubert Humphrey was sabotaging him, and no one knew that it was Richard Nixon's little underlings who were pulling the strings.
Do you think that the lessons of Richard Nixon's career are particularly relevant today?
I think they're becoming less relevant, actually. I think that the ground is shifting beneath our feet once more. I mean, there was a fascinating special election in the first Tuesday in May in Mississippi, in which the same kind of Nixonian TV commercials were run against the Democratic candidate. You know, they accused the Democratic candidate of, you know, not denouncing Barack Obama when he called rural people bitter and said that they were clinging to gods and guns. And lo and behold, it didn't work. This Mississippi district voted in the Democrat by about 8 points. So, you know, I think we're in the midst of a very, very, very unsettled political movement. And the last sentence of my book is we're living in Nixon land still. But, you know, you never know in history, but maybe we're not.
Well, Rick Perlstein, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Author and historian Rick Perlstein speaking with Dave Davies. Perlstein's new book is called Nixon Land: The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. Dave Davies is senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. Many of the most popular action movie franchises of recent years, the X-Men trilogy, the Fantastic Four films, even the recent hugely popular Iron Man, originated as comic books either co-created or sometimes drawn by artist Jack Kirby. His influence on pop culture began when he co-created the character of Captain America in 1940, and it hasn't stopped since. Right after Iron Man became a mega hit on its opening weekend, Marvel Studios announced that future projects on its schedule included movie versions of Captain America and Thor, and a new big-screen version of The Incredible Hulk is right around the corner. All of those characters wouldn't exist if not for Jack the King Kirby. His partnership with Stan Lee at Marvel Comics in the 1960s was wildly influential and changed the direction of comics. Mark Evanier met and worked for Jack Kirby at a young age and has just written a combination biography and art book. It's called Kirby, King of Comics. And it's the second book Evanier has written about an influential but often overlooked art form lapped up by young readers. The first was a book on Mad Magazine. Mark Evanier has written for comics, but also has written for TV. He was a story editor on Welcome Back, Kotter, and worked on one of the most infamous TV failures of all time, Pink Lady and Jeff. But when I spoke with Evanier, we were both most eager to talk about Jack Kirby. Mark Evanier, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Jack Kirby, who created or co-created such comic book icons as Captain America, Fantastic Four, and the X-Men, is he credited correctly or given too much credit for changing the illustrations from sort of comic strip to a much more dynamic, all over the page, all over the spread kind of thing? Was that really Jack Kirby?
I think that the two people who, well, three actually, counting Jack's partner, Joe Simon, and also the other one would be Will Eisner, were the men who invented comic books as being different from comic strips. Before Kirby and before Eisner, a comic book was a repasted newspaper strip page, and it had all the limitations of those little 3-4 panel syndicated strips, panels of all the same height, everything tucked in neatly, distance shots, not a lot of different camera angles. Unnecessarily, Jack was one of the first people to say, we're doing comic books here, and he had his characters start spilling out of the pages. He designed pages as a whole as opposed to just designing individual panels. And he did full page panels. He did double page spreads. He did, Jack liked big pictures. And when he did do newspaper strips, he found them confining and small. And when he had that big canvas to paint on with comic books, he just cut loose.
Jack Kirby was born Jacob Kurtzberg. And
yes.
So many of the key figures in the golden age of comics, I mean, not only Kirby, but Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, who created Superman, and Bob Kane, who created Batman, and Stan Lee of Marvel Comics, and M.C. Gaines of Mad, they're all Jewish. Why so many and why so influential?
Well, I think that part of it was that comic books were an easy entrance business in the late 30s, early 40s. It was one of the few fields where a kid could sit down at the kitchen table, whip up something, go in and get a glamour job. There were ads in the New York Times and other places for people who'd want to do comics. And in the early days, there was no one who was so lousy that the industry couldn't find some place for them. So that was part of it. Also, there was a certain sense of camaraderie. An awful lot of the guys who got into comics earlier not only were Jewish, but they all came from the same high school.
Really?
You know, Will Eisner, who did The Spirit, and Bob Kane, who did Batman, were in the same high school together. They were in DeWitt Clinton High. And a lot of this was people getting their buddies in. So, you know, I got into comics. Oh, I'll follow you into the field. You know, right now, if you got all your friends into your line of work, you'd be bringing in a lot of people who probably were matched your ethnicity or at least your income or your neighborhood. So I think there was a certain amount of that, too. There was also an awful lot of Italian kids, same reason, who got into comics in the early days. They knew each other. They helped each other out. But also it was a field you could get into with very easy access because it wasn't on the radar of real illustrators or real writers at the time.
Was there any anti-Semitism in terms of them not being able to get other jobs in ad agencies at the time? Or
I don't know of any of that. A lot of these guys did not have education. There was a prejudice in ad agencies, I think, against someone who didn't have, you know, 2 years of Pratt Institute on their resume. And an awful lot of the guys who got into comics in the early days were self-taught. So I think that that was a difference. If you were poor enough, if you were too poor to go to Pratt Institute and become, you know, the next Norman Rockwell, you could ad-lib something and become the next Chester Gould in comic books.
Early in Jack's career, he drew under various pseudonyms and signed his art with different names. Why did he do that, and where did he get the names?
Jack started off, one of his earliest jobs in comics was in a very low-rent newspaper syndicate called Lincoln Features, which was kind of the 99-cent-only store of newspaper syndicates. And they did quite a few different strips, so they wouldn't all have the same name on. They put different names on every strip. And it was very common at the time for Jewish kids to try to sound less Jewish in their signatures. You know, Al Kaplan became Al Cap in the Little Abner strip, not so much because they were trying to hide their heritage, but because you wanted to sound like a professional. You wanted to want one of those, you know, just like actors change their names to something that sounds like an actor. Jacob Kurtzberg did not sound like an artist. Jack Kirby did. And Jack just put all these different names. I think some of them, I don't think he even came up with some of them. Kurtzberg, I assume somebody just kind of tried Kirby because it was shortened from Kurtzberg.
And was Stan Lee's name Stan Lee?
Stan's name at birth was Stanley Lieber. And Stan at that point, like a lot of guys who got into comics in the early days, thought, well, I'll just do this for a few years and then I'll go off and I'll become, you know, more successful. Stan was going to write the Great American Novel. And so he was saving Stanley Lieber for the Great American Novel because, you know, at some point it might not be advantageous to have people know that this great novelist had written, you know, Ziggy Pig comics at one time in his life. So he just shortened his name and signed it Stan Lee for a while and never changed.
Jack Kirby created Captain America with Joe Simon in 1940. And then he went off and enlisted in the war and then came home to draw war comics. When he came back and he started drawing war comics, how revealing were those comics? What did you find?
He didn't start initially drawing war comics. When he came back, he picked up drawing Boy Commandos, the book he'd left, which I guess was a war comic in a way. And he left off, and he and Simon started romance comics about that time. They drew a few superhero books, and they did a lot of crime comics. In the post-war era, the comic book industry went through a very dizzying spiral where they weren't sure what was going to sell. The business had been founded, or a certain part of the business had been founded on superhero books. They were in decline. And Jack was always all about making sales in a very benevolent, strong way. He always wanted to do a comic book that would sell well. War comics came along at some point in there, and they were popular, and mostly in the 50s. But the war had a very strong impact on Jack. In his later years, Jack had nightmares, and he would have two nightmares. He would usually have each of them at least once a week. One of them would be back in World War II. He would dream, have these nightmares. He was back in World War II. And the other nightmare he would have, increasingly after the 50s, was being out of work and being unable to provide for his family. And I suspect that the latter was more life-threatening to him. But he talked about World War II incessantly. If you were with Jack for more than about 15 minutes, you got a World War II story out of him. It was a life-changing experience for him. And he was very proud of his service, but very overwhelmed by the entire thing. I don't think he ever quite got over it.
Is it something that you think would fall under the category of post-traumatic stress disorder?
I think Jack's whole life was post-traumatic stress disorder in the industry, if not in the war. I would think that there was some of that. I think that it was You know, Jack was a, and I mean this in a good sense, he was an armchair fantasist. He was sitting in a little kitchen table for years, at a little dank drawing table, drawing galaxies and drawing other worlds and drawing places he had not been, only that he'd been only in his imagination. The war comics were the only time he was drawing someplace that he had actually physically gone. And he had very, very strong opinions about the war. He had, when he was working with Stan Lee on the Marvel comics of the 60s, one of the areas where he and Stan had real arguments, genuine knockdown, drag-out arguments creatively, was about the way the war was being depicted in the book they did, Sergeant Fury. And Jack finally left that book in large part because Stan was not depicting the war the way Jack felt it should be depicted. And, you know, and Jack was fine with, you know, lots of different depictions of superheroes and the Phantom Zone and Asgard. You could do a lot of different things to it, but you couldn't tell Jack how it had been on the beaches of Normandy.
At some point in Kirby's career, he ran right into the buzzsaw of Frederick Wortham, who was the psychiatrist who wrote Seduction of the Innocent, and it was basically McCarthyism of comic books. Can you describe how rabid that scare was and what effect that had on Jack and on comic books then?
Well, one of the biggest effects it had on him is that Jack and Joe Simon had their own comic book company at the time, I think, and their distributor was also distributing EC Comics, which were the leading horror comics, and the comic book scare put the distributor out of business and it put Jack's company out of the business with it. So that was a very real thing. It also demeaned Jack's business. He hated what it did to the whole field. The remaining publishers got together and came up with this thing called the Comics Code, which Jack felt was a protection racket. It was the leading publishers getting together to squeeze out the small ones and to consolidate their power to control the newsstands. And he didn't like that. He didn't like the fact that Jack was a detester of monopolies, of these power structures that didn't give the little guy a break. As mad as he was at Wortham for demeaning the industry and harming the industry and putting all these guys out of work all these writers and artists out of work, he was probably maddest about the fact that what resulted from it was this power structure where if you wanted to do a comic book, you had to submit it to the Comics Magazine Association of America, which meant essentially letting the publisher of Archie approve your work.
Explain, if you can, when we're talking about a Jack Kirby comic, how much of the writing he actually did, because, you know, I sort of know him as an artist, but he gets some credit for shaping stories. How did that work and how did he work in his partnerships?
Well, Jack was always involved in the story of everything he did to some extent. The few comics where he didn't are some of the most vapid, uninteresting things he ever drew. And nobody really wanted to employ Jack as merely a taker of dictation. He had a great story sense. He wrote a lot of things himself. He co-wrote a lot of them with other people. In the 60s, when they were doing the Marvel books, which most people know him for, they had this method of working where he and Stan Lee would get together on the phone or in person. They would figure out what the story was about. Sometimes Jack would have the idea. Sometimes Stan would have the idea. They would embellish the idea. Jack would go home and he would write. He would draw up the 20 pages or whatever it was, either from based on that conversation, based on a plot outline that Stan would type up after the meeting, or Jack would just make stuff up on his own. It worked all different ways, and then Stan would put in the dialogue after the story was penciled. This led to a certain amount of friction because Jack felt that while he was being credited only as the artist on a lot of this work, he was making up the storylines and figuring out what happened in each panel. He thought that was writing work. Stan felt that since he was writing the balloons, that was the writing work. And, you know, there's a semantic argument there which we could mud wrestle over. But the point is that Jack was contributing more than merely drawing up Stan's ideas. And mm-hmm. Stan has not made any secret of that. He's said it on many, many occasions.
So how would you summarize Jack Kirby's relationship with Stan Lee?
Jack's relationship with Stan Lee was very stormy. It changed over the years. It's no secret that Jack felt he was not compensated properly or credited properly for a lot of the work, and he took some anger at that out of Stan. Stan was not happy with Jack for leaving. He was not happy with some of the things Jack said. They had a contentious relationship at times. There were times they got along. I'm in a very odd position. I worked for both men at different times and, you know, mediated a few little disputes here and there and respect them both tremendously. It's a very complicated relationship. that is complicated by the fact that both of these men were working in an industry where they only had so much power and an industry which did not credit either of them properly or give either of them enough compensation. Stan has lived long enough to get the compensation and credit he deserves, and now he is an icon. He goes places, and he's a celebrity, and people throw money at him to be Stan Lee, and I think that's terrific. There was a time when that wasn't the case, and he was being victimized by the way the industry worked as well.
When Fantastic Four number one came out in 1961, how revolutionary was that and why?
Well, it was revolutionary to a lot of us reading comics at that time because, for one thing, it was the first time we got to be on the ground floor of something. If you were reading Superman and Batman, wherever you came into it, they'd existed for, you know, a decade before you. There was all this history you couldn't catch up on. So that was a big deal, something new that was created for us. It had the same impact to a certain extent as a lot of music groups of the 60s did, where part of the appeal was that it wasn't your father's music, it wasn't your parents' music, it was yours. Another thing that was revolutionary about the Fantastic Four, and this is more evident in hindsight than it maybe was at the time, is that they were comics that went to another level. Prior to Fantastic Four, most superhero comics were about one thing. They were about catching the villain. And in 7 pages, Batman would face the villain, and he would fail 3 times to catch the villain. He'd catch him the third or fourth time, and that was the end of the story. And it was only about that. And the Fantastic Four was about the people as much as it was about the hero versus villain mentality. The characters quarreled among themselves. They had relationships among themselves. They had different personality. If you had a scene of the Fantastic Four talking to among themselves, each character had a different attitude, and you could probably identify them just by the balloons if you didn't even know who they were pointing to. That was not the case with a group shot in some of the superhero comics that had preceded that. The characters all talked alike, had the same motives. Most of the comic books prior to Fantastic Four number one, the superhero books, were kind of committee written. There were 9 guys writing Superman. There were 8 guys writing Batman. And that homogenized the work down. Fantastic Four was Stan and Jack. For the first 100 issues, it was just Stan and Jack who were creatively, if not in sync, they were at least working in the same direction generally. And the work seemed fresh. It seemed like it was targeted to you as a youngster as opposed to being told by your, a story being told by your great uncle to you, which was the mood of the DC books at the time. And you were in the beginning of a revolution, and it just got better and better. And it was something exciting about going to the newsstand every week and finding the new Marvel because there'd be something new in it, whereas the DC books at the time didn't have comparable surprises. You weren't watching something being birthed.
With this book being published by Abrams and with the previous book you did on Mad Magazine, why do you think these particular pieces of pop culture are getting more respect lately?
I think because people who grew up in the 60s and 70s are now in the age to are now of an age to be writing the books and the magazines, to be the shapers, the articulators of American pop culture. I think we're all in a position. This is oddly, if it's something that Jack kind of forecast. He was well aware that kids who grew up on his comics were one day going to be running movie studios and running networks and film critics and television critics and such. And these people, this is the influence. This is what matters to us. And Jack knew there was going to be a major motion picture of the Hulk and the Silver Surfer and the Fantastic Four. He knew it in his heart. The people he was working for at the time didn't know that and didn't pay him accordingly. But Jack knew that. And he knew what the comic book convention in San Diego was going to become. He forecast that exactly.
And really?
In the early 70s, Jack was the guest of honor at the first comic convention in San Diego. I was there. We had about 500 people at the convention. I think 300 of them were there for his talk. And we thought that was exciting, 300 people at one place. And you go to the comic book convention now, there's 300 people ahead of you in line to buy a hot dog. But Jack knew exactly. He said at that point, and I swear to you, this is almost a verbatim quote. He said in 70, 71, 72, he says, "Someday this convention will be so big it'll take over all of San Diego, and this will be where Hollywood will come every year to find out what they're going to make next year in movies and to promote what they made last year in movies."
It's exactly what's happened.
Yes. And at the time he said it, we kind of went, "Oh, yeah, sure, Jack, that'll happen." Right.
Well, Mark Evanier, thanks very much. Good luck with your book, and thanks for being on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Evanier. His new book is called Kirby, King of Comics. And just as an aside, Randy Silverman, wherever you are, If you're listening, I want my comic books back. I sold you my entire complete Marvel comic collection, including all those Jack Kirby classics, when we were in seventh grade. You paid me $75, but if you give them back, I'll pay you double. Terry isn't here today because she's in New York, receiving the Columbia Journalism Award for 2008. It's the highest honor bestowed by Columbia's School of Journalism. So congratulations, Terry. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.